Hey, everyone. Thank you for joining me again on the BIPOC Outside podcast. I'm Chris Cromwell, and today we're sitting down with Garina Lopez. Garina is a Yaqui citizen, a visual artist, storyteller, a cyclist, and the founder of Native Women Ride and the Indigenous Cycling Collective. So let's get into it, shall we? Garina, hello. So let's jump right into it. You are originally from the San Francisco area, is that correct?
I was born there, yes, in the late 70s. My parents met there. And my tribe is the Pascua Yaqui tribe, which is a border tribe in the Tucson area. So we have two reservations there. And that's where I participated in my ceremonies. And so my dad is from that general region, rather. And so my extended family is there. I grew up with my dad and my brother. And then we lived in the Southwest. I lived in northern New Mexico, went to Paris for a couple of years, Barcelona for a year. But I moved back home to San Francisco when I was in my late teens and spent my 20s there in photography.
Amazing. And now you're DC based.
Yes, I am.
All right. You've been an outdoors person your entire life. And one of the things that I've always appreciated with the way that you talk about being in the outdoors is you make the distinction between being in the outdoors as an athlete through a Western worldview versus an Indigenous worldview. And talk to me a little bit about that.
I think it's impossible for me to separate who I am. I noticed that when people want me to send, they ask for my bio, for example, I'll often have white people correct my grammar. And they will place my tribal affiliation, like they'll move the words around. So for example, when I think of myself, I think of myself as a Native woman, a Yaqui, to be specific, from my tribe, or Yoeme, which is our how we say it in our language, a Yaqui woman, more broadly, a Native or Indigenous woman. And if it's something, if we're talking about some outdoors situation, I've had this happen recently, which was I was speaking on a panel and they said, what do you think of this for the poster? And it said, Garina Lopez, athlete / and then my tribal affiliation. And I said, no. Yeah. So exactly. So I think for me, I'm always going to be a Native, Indigenous, a Yaqui. Like my culture will always come first. And then because I was born into this like gender binary, that I've chosen to stay in, but I also really connect with the matriarchy broadly with Indigenous communities, but also within my own. I'll be an Indigenous woman. And then I'm everything else. Like everything else comes afterwards because all of these, this, my culture informs everything about me. And so that's always my perspective when I'm in the outdoors is I'm not, this is the body that, this is just the vessel. And I'm so grateful for it. I'm so thankful for it. And I have so much gratitude towards this body, but at the same time, I'm hyper aware of the space that I occupy. If I'm a guest on someone's land, if I'm visiting an Indigenous community, or if I'm just riding my bike on a trail here, that's just the way my mind works because that's how I was raised. And it's not like I was raised on in some kind of like distant reservation. Our tribe we're urban natives, but because our ceremonies are informed by our creation stories, which are informed by our ecosystems, that was just the way that I was taught how to see the world, is to look at not necessarily a hierarchy, but that I'm a guest even in my own territories, and that the higher being, the creator, could be the plants, it could be the celestial beings, it could be the water, and that my responsibility as a guest in these spaces is to care for it. But I'm never going to be that kind of first. And it'll never be like a woman who's Yaqui. The kind of like anthropomorphism, I don't try to center being human first, right? I try to look at it as this is the space that I'm in. This is the person I am. This is how I was informed to look at this space. And then what am I doing in this space? Am I a student? Am I an athlete? Very long way to answer your question. But that's essentially how I think that's how I enter most spaces, honestly.
I really appreciate that. I really appreciate that understanding. And I also appreciate, which seems not common, and we say this on the show all the time, Indigenous people, like Black people, like there are no monoliths. but it seems a fairly common approach within Indigenous nations and Indigenous thought that there is no hierarchy of being. Humans are not above the natural world, the seen and unseen parts of our world, and that blows most Western people's minds. They just can't get over that humans do not have primacy in the space.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Like this 7-pound nightmare behind me, my cat, she reminds me all the time. Animals remind you all the time of your powerlessness, right? Of your lack of control. I mean, she wakes me up, her and her brother wake me up at 4 a.m. They don't care that I'm bigger than them. They don't care that I pay the rent. These are my roommates that do nothing for me.
Yeah.
They don't pay the rent. They don't do anything. But and they dictate my whole day.
Yeah, my 100-pound freeloader is just behind the screen here. And he dictates my entire life.
So yeah, I feel like, yeah, I'm sorry, I don't remember the exact question. But yes, I don't think it is a very Western mindset, that kind of individualism that I believe that we are fed here, at least in the so-called U.S., where, and we see it in the outdoor industry, where it's like in the language of being a pioneer, in the language of manifest destiny, that gets regurgitated by a lot of white people on the land because they're trying to dominate it with this kind of genocide mindset. And so I, when I'm in these kind of outdoor spaces and I can see visibly that they're very white or very white male, I listen. I do what my elders told me, and I sit back and listen to, again, like, where is my place in this? If I even have a place where I want to be in it. But it is very self-centered, a lot of navel gazing, a lot of hierarchies, and incredibly individualistic.
In a talk that you gave, I'm not exactly sure when, but I noted this, you spoke about your discomfort of being identified as an environmentalist because it erased your lived experience. And I loved that. And would you talk to me a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's funny because when I was growing up, environmentalists were white people. They were just like white people in the 70s who, I don't know, chained themselves to Greenpeace boats and stuff like that. You know what I mean? It was just, and do you, right? But that was because the way that my dad explained, the way we saw these folks demanding attention for like the work that they were doing as environmentalists, even my brother and I at a very young age were like, you guys started the problem. Like, why are you out here blaming yourself? It just didn't make any sense to me. So I always, environmentalists was almost like feminism. And I think the reason why that I recoiled from that was at a later age realized that it was white feminism that I was recoiling from. And that was the dominant perspective and continues to be, right? And so environmentalism, initially, my understanding of it was this very white space of John Muir, this Sierra Club, members only, like exclusive space for people who had time and who had the luxury of choosing to live without electricity, choosing to live in the woods. But again, when I was living in northern New Mexico, there were a lot of, and I feel like I don't have to, I feel like it's redundant to say white hippies, but that's essentially what it was, is you had all these folks who were like the back to the land, but this wasn't actually their land. And I went to school with their kids. Like, they ended up in northern New Mexico and Santa Fe to find themselves in the 70s, like tripping on acid and stuff. And then I went to school with their kids, and it was just really weird. Like, I had never really met white people before. We had moved from Tucson. And this was, and a lot of them called themselves environmentalists. And I was just, and they felt like very much like we were on the same page. Like, they were on the same page with the Indians, right? Like, we're both trying to save the land, right? Like, we're both trying to do the same thing. It was so confusing to me. Like, it took me years to figure out, like, I just did not like that term being applied to me per se. Because again, it felt like a very, like a John Muir, like a very white man's, white saviorist perspective. But also it didn't speak to the root of the problem. That was what was being ignored, right? And again, it was the people who were crying about it were the folks who actually had caused the problem. Whereas what might be considered environmentalism today by Indigenous standards or from like Indigenous communities is just our way of life. It's just the way that we come into our understanding of our ecosystems. And a lot of that is because we It's like, why would we poison the water we're drinking? Like, just like literally like, very logical stuff. I'm not talking about celestial tripping on. No, I'm talking about like, why wouldn't you care for the land that you're living on if it's going to feed you, if you're growing the food from it, right? So that didn't sound to me like environmentalism. And so I do struggle with that title because I'm just like, that's not the point. I feel like there is no separation between the land and the people. So why should there be this extra label, which is also a very Western thing? Let me figure out how to categorize you. And again, like the only category, so to speak, that I'm okay with the old label would be that I'm a member of my tribe, my community, because that's undeniable. And then all the things that I do as a responsible person in my community come after that. And hopefully they're good things, right? Hopefully being a mom, hopefully being whatever it is, a storyteller. These are things that I exist because I believe in the reciprocity in community. I believe in the in the relationships that I'm developing. I'm not trying to extract them. Whereas I feel like Western perspective with environmentalism is still a one-way road. It's like, listen to me. And centering the voices of humans over whatever animal or landscape that these environmentalists are fighting for, so to speak.
No, that's incredible. And I appreciate you comparing that to your approach to feminism. As a Black biracial woman, it took me into my 40s to understand why I really was against the ideals behind feminism. I'm against white feminism. Intersectional feminism, on the other hand, Black feminisms, Indigenous feminisms, these speak to me.
Yes, no, absolutely. I shared a tweet before it was X, and I share it every once in a while. I have to like find it. I started using Twitter as a device to edit my own words because I'm like, I don't have any followers, but it's a really interesting way to edit your own language and learn how to write concisely and precisely. And even if you want it to like, it teaches you how to be a poet in many ways. And so what I would do is I would really think about this heavy topic that I wanted to speak on. And then you only have whatever number of characters it is. And then I take a screenshot of it and share it on Instagram, right? Where I could open up the conversation a little bit. And one of the tweets I shared quite a while ago was this idea of the toxicity of in the word sisterhood and how sisterhood really implies this equity across all feminisms, and it denies the varying levels of oppression even within intersectionalities. But so it's, I just, and it, what it does is it compresses the non-white experience into one, so that we become this like glob of non-white women, feminists, whatever you want to call us, versus the white perspective. And it's always this kind of, we are still having to compare ourselves to this other, which is the whiteness, right? Because that's always a starting point. That's always the place to begin. And so I shared this tweet, which is obviously much more succinct than that, which is why I use Twitter. But it was just about sisterhood is, it feels very misleading. And if we don't recognize the levels of the differing kinds of oppression, then we're just feeding the monster. We're just using this label again, and not, and we're denying the specific experiences of each race or ethnicity or whatever, what have you.
We're going to talk more about like compressing identities, but first I want to talk about cycling. So you have been a cyclist for a long time, and I like the way you talk about using your body and using cycling to work through emotions. Talk to me about that.
Yeah. So as you mentioned, I've always been very athletic. I've done a lot of things just because I think I'm wiggly in general. And I think a lot of it was because I was raised by my dad with my brother, and he raised us like two boys. He didn't really know, he didn't care to differentiate. So he was just like, go outside. And I followed my brother. I was like, I'll do whatever you do. And so my natural inclination is to just get outside and move my body. But I would say that I also danced when I was younger, and I grew up in a house of musicians. And while I toyed with learning instruments, for me, feeling the music, embodying the music through dance was very healing. And I practiced dance for years and years, and I would interweave it through running and cycling and doing other forms of movement. But it really wasn't until I started to ride my bike, not through commuting where you have to be, that's not meditative. That's not very healing. It's just like you're just trying to survive. And it's great to move your body that way, but you really have to be focused. Whereas when I started to ride gravel or whatever you want to call it, like on the dirt roads, and similarly running on trail running, you can really lose yourself in the landscape in a different way. And suddenly you're with your breath and you're much more, or at least I found that I was able to tap into a space of healing, being on my bike and being on the land in that way. And all that is to say is that I realized early on that moving my body was a way to help with my depression. It was really a way to start my day to ground me, because I have a lot of wiggles and I feel every day I need to conquer a little bit of a mountain, even if that's just going on a walk, right? And to calm my body. And cycling is really interesting because I think for me, the main challenge of cycling as a sport, there were a lot of challenges because it's a very white male sport. There's a serious financial barrier to entry. I didn't even realize that it really could be a sport for me until the pandemic. I honestly had been commuting for 20 some years at that point. I thought you had to wear spandex and be wealthy and ride very expensive bikes to be part of the sport. I honestly did not think of myself as being somebody that could enter that space. It was like very foreign to me because I had never met, I'd never seen anything but like Tour de France on TV. There was nothing from between that and commuting. I didn't know anything between, right? Now I do, obviously. And there are many more opportunities that exist. But I think one of the things that was difficult for me was the body image part of it, because cycling, I have really strong legs, and riding a bike makes my legs even stronger and more muscular. And that was something that was, I still grapple with, where I love being on my bike. I love riding on the land and going for hours and hours and watching the landscape change and watching the turtles come and go and watching just like throughout an entire year, I can see not only the seasonal changes and the topography, but I can watch the animals. I can see the deer, the little ducklings, and literally watching families over the years, right? And it's really quite beautiful. But then I have to contend with, and all that feels very good in my heart and in my soul. And then I have learned to really, I shouldn't say contend because it makes it sound like it's like there's a very aggressive relationship, but accepting the physical body that gives me the power to do this, but that may not look like the body that I want it to look like, because I can become so muscular. But I would say, like, on the other side of that is in the bike space, it's not unusual. So on the one hand, it's good to have these big, strong muscles in the bike space. It's when I'm not on the bike that all of that things I love to do on the bike, it's hard for me to be comfortable in my body, I would say.
Yeah, I feel that as a skier and a year-round cyclist, and I'm just over 5 feet, and it feels like I am just a big pile of legs.
Which is a beautiful thing. I think that when you get to this time, a place in your life where you can just say, thank you, body. Thank you, legs. You're so grateful. You're so grateful because this is not just a vessel. It does so much for us. And it's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing.
So you started Native Women Ride during the pandemic. Tell me about the impetus. Tell me about why you wanted to go from an individual cyclist in the space to creating this wonderful community.
Yes, March is going to be a 3-year anniversary. It's just crazy. So I will be planning. I'm trying to figure out what to do, but let's see. I guess around this time, what year was that? 2019? Is that when the pandemic started? No, 2020 is the pandemic.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had seen a friend of mine sent me a Instagram flyer looking for people of color on bikes. And again, I was like, what? That exists? But in the race space, like racing. And the thing basically said, we are trying to encourage people of color to get on bikes and start racing. And I was like, maybe, I don't know. I've been having a lot of injuries as a runner, and then the pandemic happened and I was on my bike a lot more. And I applied for this team to ride on this team and to do a race, which would have been my first race. And I got on and I was like, oh my God, what am I doing? I don't even have a race bike. I have one bike. that I called my donkey, my burro, because it had these giant panniers on it. The thing weighed like 50, 60 pounds. It was so heavy. I used to like twist my wrist every day just trying to get it up the stairs. And I thought, I was with a race in this thing. But the more that I learned about the cycling space, the more intimidated I became. And it was mainly because coming from running, where I had done a lot of work already in representation, essentially, talking about Indigenous people in running and working with in solidarity with Black athletes and Asian athletes and different running groups like this on issues related to the murder of George Floyd, on issues related to Ahmaud Arbery, because I've been a runner my whole life. That was the space that I was used to being in. And so when I peeked behind the curtain of cycling, I was like, oh my God, it's so blindingly white. And I was like, do I really want to do this? Do I really want to go to this place, right? And so I started to do my research and I was like, what's the Indigenous representation like in cycling? And it was zilch. It was Shayna Paulus and Nielsen Paulus, who are like the top tier. And then I couldn't find any. I knew of a couple of people that I had followed in social media, but I was like, I couldn't find any. It was just the representation was so little. Like, I still have this one document that I made when I did that research, because I looked for articles, I looked for people, like individual, I looked for groups, and it doesn't even fill one page. And I was so disappointed. In my mind, I thought, I want to show up to this first race and see other Native cyclists. That's what I was excited about. And I couldn't find anybody. And there was one other Native person on the team, my Navajo friend, Sinny, who ended up doing the ride to Carlisle with me. He's became like my little brother. And so he and I were talking about that a lot. And essentially, I was just like, you know what? One of my best girlfriends is Verna Volker. She started Native Women Running, which is also an Instagram account that highlights Indigenous women runners, right? And she had featured me a couple times on the page. And I asked her, I said, Verna, could you help me start something like this for bikes? And she was like, I don't ride bikes. I don't really know, but I'll support you. And I was like, okay. So I started the account Native Women Ride. And Verna was the first person I featured. And I honestly just thought, nobody's going to find this thing. And I just spent the first couple of weeks following anybody of color on a bike. I had no idea who these people were. I was just following them. I tagged some folks. I tagged Shayna Paulus, and she immediately started sharing stuff. I was like, oh, she's like a normal person, right? She's very friendly. And yeah, my impetus was very simple, was find other Native people on bikes, specifically women. Really wanted to find non-men, femtrans, non-binary. But again, it took a long time. And so that was basically it. And once the momentum kind of started picking up, which was just through word of mouth in the running space, I was like, please share this with everybody. I need to find other Native people on bikes. It's really hard. Once the momentum started picking up, I decided that I also wanted to use the space to educate about the land that we ride on. And so that became one of the main goals. It was like a three-prong approach: find other Indigenous peoples on bike, educate about the land we ride on, and fundraise for issues impacting our communities. And once I figured that out, because at first I was just like, it's just a page. And then I realized, wait a second, maybe I could try to build something with this. So that was essentially the beginning of it. Very simple. Just wanted to find other friends.
Incredible. You've been very intentional with Native Women Ride about using an inclusive definition of women.
That has been interesting, because obviously Native Women Ride is the name of the group. And I've had to multiple times explain the definition or the concept of women. And I've also had a lot of conversations with Indigenous riders who identify as non-binary and feeling like they didn't fall under that label. And so very early on, I didn't want to change the name of the group, or the page rather. And so very early on, like underneath the name, the bio says FTWMB on bikes. And that was something that I had to reinforce a lot, that this space was really to welcome non-men, essentially. But the that language is also very Western. Then there would be like Two-Spirit friends who were like, I'm not non-binary, I'm Two-Spirit. I'm not trans, I'm Two-Spirit. I'm not femme, I'm Two-Spirit. And yeah, so it's been an interesting journey trying to find a way to be inclusive. So About a year ago, I did consider changing the name of the group, but then I was like, oh my God, it took me so long to build this following. And I did ask some other folks who had done something similar like that, and they had suggestions about how to move forward from like a marketing perspective. And I didn't have any merch made. Like, I wasn't going to lose any money per se. I don't make any money off of this endeavor, but I was very concerned about having to rebuild essentially the community. And so then I decided, it took me a while to come up with what now is called the Indigenous Cycling Collective, because I wanted to find framework to include everyone, even basically like any Indigenous person. You can call yourself whatever you want to call yourself. So it's still Native Women Ride. And then right below that, it says, and the Indigenous Cycling Collective. And on the website, it states pretty clearly that there's two different funding streams, essentially. Native Women Ride still focuses on FTWMB and Two-Spirit folks. And then Indigenous Cycling Collective includes anybody who wants to apply to a scholarship or who needs funding, or if I get mutual aid, if I get clothing, so on and so forth. But I do still prioritize the original group. But again, it's when you're living in a Western society in a colonized world, you're having to use their language all the time, which isn't inclusive. But also, the page itself is very, it's interesting because I wanted it to be a space for us, by us. But I find that I'm oftentimes, when I'm putting together a post, I'm trying to speak to Native and Indigenous people. I'm trying to speak to us, but the majority of the followers are not Native. And yeah, because I would say, like, the majority, if you think about like the percentage of people in the United States was that are Indigenous is 2%. That percentage carries over pretty much in the workplace, in academia, even less, probably in social media. So I do have a lot of support in the Native community for sure. And so it's only been until recently that I've been like, you know what? If they don't know what I'm talking about, it's not for them anyway. They're a guest. Just like you're a guest on our land, you are a guest in this space. And I don't need to explain everything to you, because I found that I was doing that a lot in the beginning, where I was like, what does res mean? Like, very, yeah. And I would even have non-Native people like educating me in the DMs and being like, seriously, like telling me how to, what kind of language to use, what kind of inclusive language, because it made them feel excluded, but they weren't Native. After getting so many of those kinds of responses, I was just like, you know what? No, I'm not going to pander to the white gaze. I know that I had to tiptoe into this space that way because cycling is so white, but I didn't, I don't, I'm not doing this for white folks. I am doing this to build community for and by us. So I'm going to use the language that we know. And if you don't know what Skoden means, then too bad for you.
Like, Google is free.
Exactly. We live within the confines of the white man's world, and I've had to learn their language. And so I do think of the Instagram page is being very much like a brick and mortar club in a way, where I'm like, if I actually had this brick and mortar club called the Indigenous Cycling Collective and people were coming in and out, I wouldn't be talking to them the way I talk to folks at school. You know what I mean? Like, I wouldn't be policing their language or anything like that, right? I would just be trying to let them be themselves and feel comfortable. The language has shifted more in that direction. I would say that everything has the language of women having to explain things. I'm just like, it's the Indigenous Cycling Collective. We know what we're talking about. I have a listserv. I talk to our folks on the back end. The stuff that goes on the Instagram page, yes, is sometimes more generalized, but I always follow it up with an email to everybody on the listserv, and they know where I stand.
The Instagram page. This all started on Instagram. Social media can be brilliant because it can expand your reach far outside of your
Yes.
locale, your region. But social media can also be hugely problematic. Tell me,
Similar.
particularly for racialized women who have an opinion. So tell me about social media safety. What tips and tricks can you give those of us who are in the space and learning?
Yeah, I learned the hard way, because I really didn't go into this having done any kind of like background. I didn't know what it would become, honestly. Like, I had zero idea that I would end up with a fiscal sponsor, like fundraising and doing all these things and having people come to me and being like, can you educate me? And that was not where I thought this was. I don't know where I thought this was going to go. I was just trying to find other Native people on bikes. Simple, right? But so I didn't do any research. And for example, one of the mistakes I made, which was to not have an email account initially. And so anybody who needed assistance would just send me a DM, right? They would just say, and I kept posting, I kept saying, just reach out to me in the DMs if you need a scholarship, if you need cycling clothing, whatever. So what that ended up doing is, rather than saying, here's the email, is it, I didn't know that I could go into my settings and only accept messages from people. I could choose who to accept messages from or DMs, right? And so now I can't do that because some of the folks never email me, even though I've now said, please send in the request via email. And a lot of that is because they live on reservations with really bad internet. And so they're just going to send me a request, a message, that fast as they can, the easiest way possible. It's probably going to be on their phone when they're thinking about it. And they're probably going to be thinking about it when they're on social media. So those are some of the things. It's like, if you're going to start a community group or an affinity group or whatever you want to call it, think about ways to protect the incoming messages, to protect yourself in that way. So that was one thing that I didn't think about. And now I am bombarded. There are a fair number of trolls. There's a lot of white supremacists. There's a good amount of threats I've gotten. I've been doxxed. My son has been threatened. Really unsavory, unwelcoming things that have made me want to just shut the whole thing down many times that nobody sees. They don't see that. They don't see the threats that I get. They don't see the vitriol that I get from white women in cycling. There's a lot of white supremacists in cycling who threaten me or other people that I'm supporting if we show up at races. Really just racist actions. I wrote an article very early on when I got my first sponsorship through SRAM and for International Women's Day 2 years ago. And I make this comparison about, I talk about the dangers of using social media for people of color, for Indigenous people who, for pretty much for so forever, have been misrepresented in media and in pop culture, and how the language, I started seeing the language being used in social media, on Twitter, on different platforms, being the same kind of language that was happening in the real world. People talk about the internet to being the Wild West, right? There's no police, like nobody can control what you're saying, and you have freedom and all this stuff, free reign. And so what I found is that white supremacists and racists, they're going to use the same language in person as they're going to use online. And they're going to call me a dirty Indian and a savage online as they would in person. Like, that's especially if I don't know them, right? Because they can hide behind their computer, their phone, whatever, right? And so they're much more willing to just attack you because they're unknown. And so I wrote this article and I basically talked about how risky it is for people of color to start affinity groups on social media, because building trust, especially with Indigenous, I'll speak obviously from being a Native person, building trust in community for Native people takes so long because of the level of mistrust, right? From doctors in schools, from doctors, there's so much extraction that has happened not only in our culture, but just like physically, like literally our bodies, our hair, in science, like everything has been stolen. And so even with other Indigenous people, sometimes we can be a little bit sus, right? We're like, want to know, can I trust you? So building trust in Native communities is really hard, takes a long time. And I used that example of realizing that my approach needed to be, if this were a brick and mortar after school program, I would not let these people in. I would not let these white supremacists in. I would not stand for that language or that behavior. But I also have to pick and choose my battles. And so I'm not going to respond to every single DM. I'm not going to respond to every single comment. So I also had to learn to turn comments off, even sometimes when I didn't want to, when there could have been a valuable conversation. So I think those are like some of the things that need to be considered when you are starting a social media page or group, is treat it like you would an in-person real life thing, because most likely you're going to be meeting these people and you're going to be supporting real people in real life and protecting them. And for me, sharing their stories, right? Because I do these profiles of folks on bikes, I'm sharing their pictures. I'm asking a lot of them. Like that, when I send out the email on the listserv and say, please let me know if you want to share your bike love story, is what I call it. I ask like a couple basic questions, but I say, you tell me your story. You do it in your language. I am not going to tell you what to say because I'm not putting words into your mouth. If you want to do it in your indigenous language, whatever you want to call yourself, just, this is your time. This is your space, right? Like, I'm not here trying to edit you. I'm not here trying to like, and I love it because I do get this. There are some profiles where it's a mixture of English and then their indigenous language. And I'm not going to translate either. Because again, this is a space for us and by us. So yeah, so those are, I guess, some of the tips, I suppose, is of how to care for oneself.
I appreciate that. That's giving me a lot to think about. So let's talk more about the work of Native Women Ride. You are, you're not just highlighting, you're also supporting community members.
Yeah. I'm doing a lot of that, more of that. Yeah. I started sending out surveys a couple years ago when I first started because I realized the need, the financial barrier to entry that I had known as a commuter just to get my bike fixed and get a new tires or gloves, or if you live in a place that has a lot of seasonal changes, just having the right gear and so on and so forth. And then if you're a growing person, if you're a kid, right, all that stuff becomes very expensive, and especially if you grow out of a bike, right? And I started to put together surveys just asking, how can I support you, and gathering data. And I'm the only person who has data on Native bike riders, like consistently. I have reached out to Strava. I have reached out to like the IH, Indian Health Services, every single Indigenous health policy and just non-Indigenous sports company. And they're not looking at us. They don't see us. And so I figured out, so I have like my surveys are iterative. And when I get the responses back, I see, oh, okay, this is what's missing. I'm going to add that to the next one. And essentially what the surveys have revealed is the very specific needs that people have based on the types of riding. So if they're mountain bike riders versus they live in the city and they're commuters versus depending on age and the location, there's some folks that need winter gear, which is quite expensive. I've done a lot of collaboration with other organizations, and one of them is called Bras for Girls, which is pretty incredible. And this is started by a runner friend of mine, because even in the running space, people think, oh, you just need a pair of shoes. But what if you're growing breasts, right? Let's not even talk about like a safe place to run, but just like the physical things, right? And so this friend of mine who started the foundation, Bras for Girls, will send me loads of bras. And so I put, it's super incredible. In the survey, I asked, what type of cycling do you do? I have a long list of how can I support you, and then I'll have shoes, give me a shoe size. I don't know, I tell everybody, I don't know if I can fulfill these orders. Do you need glasses? Do you need helmets? Do you need gloves, clips, every single thing, jerseys, winter, blah, 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 blah. You know, so I send out seasonal surveys. And so that has taken up most of my time, because on the back end, I'm either trying to find money to purchase these things for folks. I pay for bike maintenance. So somebody will take their bike into the shop. I'll call the shop and pay for the maintenance, because that's another big thing. It's like, you can get someone a bike and get them on a bike, but if they can't fix it, if they don't have the tools, if they don't even have the inner tubes to change their tires, it's just going to pick up dust. And so I encourage people all the time. I said, hit me up. I will pay for your maintenance. Please. I'm begging them to let me pay for the maintenance just so that I can stay on their bikes. And then I pay for like gas, food, and lodging if folks want to if they want to put together a little mini team, is what I call it. So I'll have a scholarship fund for that. And it's also extended to supporting some of the families with educational scholarships. And I also don't want to be, I'm not trying to be a micromanager either. If someone says, and I've made this very clear, like if you need assistance to pay rent, to get food to get diapers, to get firewood. You don't even have to tell me those things. You can just send me an email and say, I just need some assistance this month. If we have built up a rapport and you're not a stranger and I know who you are, I will Venmo you what I can, because and nobody has taken advantage of me in that way. They have maybe asked me once or twice, right? Because we've built up the trust over the years. And yeah, so a lot of it really is at this point is I am applying for grants all the time so I can get funding. The few sports brands that I have relationships with, I'm always emailing them saying, do you have any donations? Whatever, just trying to get stuff. And then I send that stuff out. I made my first merch this year. So I designed, I'm an artist, I'm a writer. So I love words and language. And I wanted to find, everybody kept saying, oh, I want some Native women ride this or that. And I was like, I don't, it's just going to be another t-shirt that no one's going to wear. So I wanted to put together a funny line of t-shirts where you could wear everywhere, anywhere. That speaks to Indian humor. And so the first one that I thought of was, and then the funds from those, the sales of the shirts go into the Venmo, which is the mutual aid. So then I'm not having to apply for grants all the time. But the first shirt that I came up with was, in the Constitution, Native people are mentioned twice. And one of them is when we are called merciless Indian savages. And so I play with that one, and I have a t-shirt that says Indian sandwiches. I think it's hilarious. Oh my God. And then the second shirt that I came up with, which a couple years ago, every Native woman was wearing, it was resilient Indigenous woman. And it's a very powerful shirt, but I was like, damn, I am tired. I am a tired Indigenous woman. Like, I am a hangry Indigenous woman. Like, I am a sexy Indigenous woman. There's just so many other, I think we're not all resilient, and neither should we be. So then I came up with playful Indigenous. I have a couple of hangry Indigenous women, playful Indigenous women. And then this is the latest one, because a lot of the Native folks or non-Native folks were like, we feel weird. We want to buy the shirts, but we're not Indigenous. And so in the wake of this, the Israel, Gaza, call it what you want, but genocide, war, all these things, and really thinking about the parallels between Indigenous communities here on Turtle Island and Indigenous communities elsewhere, but Palestinians fighting for their land there, I was thinking about the metaphor, right? And so this t-shirt says, it's giving land back as a metaphor energy. And it's a play, obviously, on language, that the it's giving energy comes from like the gay Black men community. And a lot of the gay Black male language is co-opted by straight white women. And so this is like a multi-layered criticism of, and so I wanted it to be able to appeal to my Black friends, the Asian friends, the LGBTQ friends, which is the it's giving energy. And then obviously the land back as a metaphor speaks to the land acknowledgement and hashtag land back that is so tired that people really don't get it. And then also looking at how land back does this shirt, I could also wear this to a rally for pro-Palestine. Yep. And it would still make sense, right? Anywho, sorry, I'm always so long-winded. Apologize. But yes, no,
you're great.
Because I do too many things. I got too many ideas to try to prop up this little page. I wish I would receive one of these giant grants that I applied for, because I could start regional chapters and then I wouldn't have to come up with all these wacky ideas to make money. And then I could just like literally just put the money in folks' hands and be like, your community here. That is the goal, is to one day get these $100,000 grants I've been applying for year after year, and then just be like, here, Navajo Nation, take it. Here, there's whatever tribe in Oklahoma, because there's a lot of riders there, or the Pacific Northwest, or there's a generous pockets of cyclists or city Indians or whatever, urban natives as well. So yeah, I do a lot, and it's really just because I don't have a regular stream of income for this wacky little project of mine.
It's a wonderful and I also try project.
To, thank you. And I also want it to be like fun and like you have to keep things alive. I don't know, engaging really.
I want to respect your time. We're running late. Do you still have time for me? Because I've got a few more questions.
I do.
Okay, awesome.
Yeah, I'm fine.
Okay,
I'm fine.
Awesome.
You tell me.
Oh, no, I have all day. Because with everything you're saying, I'm thinking of 12 more questions. And I'm just like, oh, gosh, I want to get these in because I don't know what the rest of your day looks like. I want to respect your time.
Oh, I'm fine. I'm totally fine.
One of the things that you do with Native Women Ride is also you collaborate with race directors to create space.
Yes.
How? Tell me about that.
Yeah, it's fallen a little bit by the wayside. Now I know I have like three different race directors that I work with. Comfortably, I totally trust them. Initially, the way that I was doing is I was using the surveys, and one of the questions was, is there a race that you're interested in riding but can't afford it? And so then they would tell me, and then I would reach out to any old random race director and say, can I have a couple of free entries, and or do you have scholarship funding, right? And people were really cheap. They're really like, they want receipts. White people always want receipts. They want to make sure that what are you really doing with the free tickets I'm giving you? What are you really doing with the free t-shirts I'm giving you? It was just too much. And then when I would put together these mini teams that they're not funding at all, I'm still out here trying to find money to pay for food, gas, and lodging, and to pay for the bike maintenance, to get the folks completely ready so there's zero financial strain on them. All I'm getting usually from the race directors is the free entries, is then they want labor. They want us, can we feature you? They want you to be their token Native person in their ad or their DEI. See, I did it. I checked that box. And I was like, no. And so I was having to show up at these races because I was like, I am not going to make that part of my agreement with the folks that I am supporting. That's not how this is going to work. I'm not going to tokenize them. But in the beginning, I really, like, you could just say yes to everything because you don't know what you're doing. Or at least I didn't know when my voice was going to be powerful enough to be able to say no. And so for the first year and a half, I was on every mini team, because I needed to be there to protect everybody else. And eventually I would say to folks, do you want to be featured? You don't have to be. They got it. And I'd be like, okay, you can just tokenize me, because it was still important to show that there were Native people at these races, definitely. And we would show up, obviously, and people were psyched. And essentially I wouldn't just show up and be like, I don't know who's there. I'd reach out to all the Black cyclists that I knew who were going to be there, the Asian cyclists, all the BIPOC cyclists that I knew were going to be there, so that we could come together and protect each other. And if I wasn't there, then I would connect all those folks with the mini team. And I'd be like, because we have like these back end chat groups or whatever, right? But it just became really a lot of haggling. And it was almost like I was begging these race directors. And it's like, what you want, why should I have to beg for three free entries for three Cherokee riders? We need the races on Cherokee land. Like, they should be getting, you know, like, I shouldn't even be having this conversation. Like, you want to be accountable to Indigenous communities, but you want me to beg for free entries for folks whose land you're riding on? No. Yeah. So I stopped reaching out to race directors. I will do it every once in a while. I will. But at the moment, there's a handful that I know have my back and are also like, they're safe spaces for folks to show up. And so that's Grounded Nebraska is amazing. And then Grit, which is the newer one. Yeah. Those two groups have done incredible jobs to be not just like inclusive, but that's safe as a person of color, or if you're queer, or if you're disabled. Like, they are doing everything in their power to make sure that inclusive is not just this statement, but it's an actual experience that you don't even have to think about.
I like that. Inclusive, not as a statement, but as an experience. That might become the title of this episode. So what year was it? Was it 2021? You did the 200, the Carlisle 200?
Yeah.
Tell me.
It was like 6 months after I started Native Women Ride. Yeah.
Tell me about the Carlisle 200. Tell me about why you wanted to do this.
I was familiar with the Carlisle Indian Industrial School, which is located in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, about 250 miles north of Washington, D.C. I knew about Carlisle because I had worked in the photo archives at the American Indian Museum at Smithsonian for a couple of years. And so I came upon Carlisle via the archives. Coming from the West Coast, I was familiar with the mission schools, which my dad was a survivor of, but I didn't ever hear about boarding schools. I thought boarding schools were like the places that rich white kids went to, right? And then when I saw this photograph of these children in front of this school, when I was working in the archives at Smithsonian, I asked somebody, I said, who are these? Like, what is this? Clearly they were indigenous children with white matrons flanking them. And I knew it was something forced assimilation, but I was like, what is this? And someone said, oh, this is the Native American, or they probably called it Indian boarding school in Carlisle. So this was 2006-07. And I was like, the what? Yeah. And so I hadn't even really learned about the history of the boarding schools on the East Coast. Like I said, I'm coming from the West Coast, very familiar with forced assimilation through Catholic schools and Franciscan monks and all this whole thing, right? And so I just started digging into it and became incredibly obsessed with Carlisle, especially after somebody said, oh, it's just up the road. You can get there in 2.5 hours. And so for years, I wrote to the media people there, not really knowing what was there. I really didn't know. I didn't know that it was an active military base to this day. I had no idea. I was just writing emails to the media people there saying, I'm a photographer, I work at Smithsonian, and I would love to come and photograph the grounds. I didn't know what was there. All I knew was that there was nothing on the internet about this. There was no stories. There was no conversation. There was one photograph in the archives at Smithsonian and maybe a couple of other. And nobody knew about Carlisle. Nobody knew about anything until you start talking to the other employees, and everybody at the Smithsonian American Indian Museum comes from different tribes all over. They would be like whisper conversations. Oh yeah, my grandparents. Oh yeah, my parents went to such and such boarding school. But it was not this topic of conversation that is people know about it, quote unquote, now. I had already been up on Carlisle for about a decade, really trying to figure out how to shed light on that history, still never having heard back from them. And then that summer of 2021, I finally got an email in May from the person running the marketing or media, the PR, and the guy said, hey, yeah, sure, give me a call. I don't know. It was wild. I hadn't emailed in years. I don't know how he got my email, but basically he said, sure, you can come up and photograph. Because I explained to him what I was trying to do and who I was. And he said, but Deb Helland will be here in a couple of weeks because we're having one of our biggest repatriation efforts of 11 children. And I still hadn't fully grasped what Carlisle was. And so he sent me, plus there still wasn't that much information available. So he sent me the link to the military website that basically explained that the grounds of the school are on this active military base. The main school itself was turned into XYZ. There's a couple of old stone buildings, but the cemetery that's there had 200 children plus who were children who had died while attending Carlisle. And that was why Deb Helland was showing up, was because they were repatriating 11 of these children. And my mind was like, what? I thought that these children had already been repatriated. I had read about how many children had died there. I didn't know that the cemetery was still there, that it was present. I started digging. Then I was able to find more information. Once I started really focusing on the cemetery aspect of it, I found these local Native groups who for the last 50 years, have taken it upon themselves to clean the graves of these children and place, once a year on Memorial Weekend, they go and they clean the graves, they do ceremony, and then they place toys in front of each of these plots and honor these children. And it's heartbreaking. And so I went after, a couple weeks after Deb Helland was there, and you'll see in the film and in some of my photographs that there are these blank spaces because these were the plots that had been repatriated. So it'll be like headstone, 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 and then some blank spots. But, and I say this in the film in Carlisle 200, one of the most shocking, there were many shocking things about being there, but was the size of the cemetery and the size of the gravestones. Everything was so small. Yeah. And I thought, it's just so shrunken. And it didn't dawn on me until I started seeing that born this year, died this year. And I was like, oh my God, these are all little children. And everything was just child size, the plots, the gravestone. I mean, everything. And 200 children were packed into the tiny little space. So that was also the same summer that the revelation, so to speak, of the first big one came out in Canada, Kamloops, about 250 children or something initially, right?
Initially.
And then it was like 2,000. It grew to like 4,000, right? Because it was like all of these other residential schools that where they were being discovered, so to speak. And the conversation had already been had started a while ago in Canada. In the US, not so much. And so that's what made me angry, was actually having gone to Carlisle with this idea of mine that I was going to photograph the grounds, getting there, seeing what was actually there, recognizing that these were children, learning about how difficult the military had made it for these communities to repatriate their children. Very difficult. Leaving, driving back home, picking my kid up from school who's the same age as these children in the cemetery, and realizing nobody fucking knows about this. Nobody's talking about this. People are barely even listening to what's happening in Kamloops. Like, they can't even grasp that there are mass graves of Native children who are our grandparents' age. Like, it wasn't even that long ago. Nobody was talking about it here. It was not in the press. The only reason why I was up on it was because I listen to Native podcasts. I read Native news, all this stuff. And I was familiar with Carla. And it just made me so mad. And I had started Native Women Ride, and I had done prayer runs before. I think like the longest prayer run I had done was maybe 10 miles or something. And I think it was probably for missing and murdered Indigenous women or for Dakota Access Pipeline. I had done these kind of group runs to raise awareness. And I mapped it out and I thought, F it, I'm going to run it. And when I do that, I'm going to raise awareness. I'm going to use my platform and I'm going to get other Native runners, because I knew a lot of other Native runners. Nobody was available. And I was like, dang, I cannot take off 2 weeks to do this run. And I'd never really been on my bike like that. And I was just, but I had finally done my first race and I did really well. And I had my friend Cindy, who's Navajo, that was on the team with me. And I just called him up and I said, do you want to do this with me? And he was like, yeah. And he's in Colorado. So he was like, yes, absolutely. And so he mapped it all out. And we had about less than 2 months to prepare. I reached out to these filmmakers to see if they wanted to follow us. I really didn't know why, but I was like, this is such an important story. It needs more than just an Instagram platform to share. And they jumped on it immediately, which was basically was a passion project for them to come with us. We had no money, no funding. They used their own money to fly, to rent, to do all the things. I finally got one tiny grant, gave it to them to pay for some of the stuff, but I covered most of the costs. And so, yeah, so we rode our bikes from DC to Carlisle, Pennsylvania over 4 days, and it was about 250 miles. It was very difficult. And throughout the journey, each day we said a prayer to 50 children. And so I would share a post with the 50 names. And then at the end of the day, I would share photographs of the landscape that we had ridden on. And then I would share whose land we were riding on. Again, like really trying to keep the message very clear that just because I'm Native does not mean that I am not a guest. I am still a guest on Indigenous land, riding through public parks where we are not named, where Black people are not named. Everything is an homage to some white Civil War general, but no mention of whose land you're riding on, nor the Black enslaved folks who were forced to work that land, right? I was trying to do all of these things. And when it became like physically difficult, which it did a lot, and it was also very emotionally draining, all I could think about was, because I had done so much research, was the children. They were called runners, the kids who used to run away from boarding schools and residential schools, who died running away, or who were caught, brought back, and then died usually after they were returned. And I just, after that, I was like, I have food, I have shelter, I have a way out, I have a choice, I can go home, but whatever, I have feet, all these things, right? This is the least I can do to raise this awareness. And so that's essentially what Carlisle was about. And it took us 2 years to finish the film because, again, we didn't have funding. And I'm super proud of it. It's a beautiful film.
Yes.
And we're just, you know, right now we have to put it out there. And so our hope is to get it to every educational institution and museum and use it as an educational piece, essentially.
And it's critical that that education is lacking. You're right that there is a little bit more public awareness about residential schools in Canada because we had the Truth and Reconciliation Commission here, a large government endeavor to bring the truth forward. That's also, of course, brought out a lot of residential school denialism.
Yep.
Our national myth of us being a kind and wonderful country is challenged by the truth of residential schools. So, of course, there is a contingent of people who need to deny that. But people have the basic information, but they don't know a lot of the intimate details. Like the Carlisle School was the blueprint. It was the first one.
Yep, yeah.
Canada learned how to build these genocidal institutions from what happened at Carlisle School.
Another interesting fact that I came upon is the general who started Carlisle, though that was put in place, General Pratt, Henry Pratt. He had come from Florida where he had experimented with, he ended up coming with a group of Apache prisoners. So those were the first children. If you look in the largest number of Native students, children that were there were Apache because they were prisoners of war in Florida. So he brought them. But he had already tried this experiment of assimilation on the quote-unquote Buffalo soldiers. So he had tried this. Yeah. So there's a really interesting connection between the Americanizing the African enslaved folks to assimilate them, and then going, it worked, but let's move on and really focus on Native people because we want their land. And now we're going to use their children as pawns to steal more land. And General Pratt had these, it was quite like a, maybe 15, 20 Apache prisoner of war, his children, and he brought them up. And that was the first group that came up, and many of them died immediately. But yeah, it's a really heartbreaking reality when you think about the fact that the Carlisle Indian School was the blueprint school for residential schools or schools in Australia, for schools in other places that where people were colonized, where Indigenous communities were colonized. It's heartbreaking when you think of the number of children and the way the children were stolen violently, taken from their communities and used as, like I said, as pawns. You want food for your entire community, you give us your children, because the children are the next generation. And of course, the word genocide didn't exist then. But when you apply the definition of genocide, part of the definition is when you're taking children from one group and forcing them into another. Right? That's the part of the definition of genocide. And Canada, as you mentioned, had the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Canada apologized, so to speak, right? Yeah, exactly. But America has never done this. And so Dent Helland, after all of these discoveries, basically said, okay, I am going to demand this. I can't remember what it's called, but it was a research project, essentially, to show the depth and breadth of the boarding schools, the number of schools, where they were, how many children died, so on and so forth, because nobody had ever done that research holistically in the U.S. And it's supposed to inform some resolutions to pass some resolutions, essentially, to support survivors of the boarding school era and to support continued research, essentially, and to get an apology.
Yeah.
Which I don't know if we'll ever get.
No. Yeah, I don't know. In Canada, there was one. I don't know that many people were thrilled or bought it.
Exactly.
Typical government.
Again, performative.
Very, yeah. It's a beautiful film. It, of course,
thank you.
Will be on the show notes for this episode. And every one of you listeners has to watch it. My last sort of big question for you, and this one is very selfish because it's something that I am trying to learn. You talked about the complexity of organizing a pan-Indigenous organization and still being mindful of the fact that indigenous peoples and nations are not a monolith, and each nation is unique in its politics and its culture, and trying not to collapse all of those different identities into each other. And you have had incredible success from those of us on the outside looking in. You've been so successful at that. And for the rest of us who are trying to organize in diverse spaces, what advice do you have for us? What tips do you have for us?
I would say I learned that skill, so to speak, as a photographer working in the street, where you have to give agency to the person whose story you're presenting and not be extractive. And so in photography, working as a street photographer, I wasn't only going to photograph unhoused people in horrid conditions in these ways that were expected. And so I would get to know folks and I would ask them about their lives. I wouldn't photograph them the first time. I'd come back with some food or some money or whatever it is that they needed, hot coffee, get to know them. And then, like I said, build the trust first and then ask them how they would like to be photographed. And I think that's really important because I always think about this whole thing is I'm a storyteller and I don't know any other way to really describe the way that I came into this, but is to give agency to the people that you're representing. So allow them to speak for themselves, which means that, let's just say, in my case, I am of this group, right? But again, I don't want to collapse every single Native person into this kind of pan-Indigenous thing where I can speak to them. We are all like this in the same language, which is why when I share the profiles, I say, no. You describe yourself. You introduce yourself the way you would want to introduce yourself in your language, because it's going to be different wherever you are, even just regional slang per se, right? And again, that's giving agency to that person. But it's also me asking them how they want to be represented. And so I'm not assuming that just because I'm also Native, that I know how they want to be written about. I'm not going to do that. I'm actually learning. You know what I mean? I'm also learning because there are close to 600 federally recognized tribes in the U.S. There's no stinking way, I would assume, to know about everything about how each individual community, some people call themselves tribes, some people are from rancherias, some people are communities, there's not even like one way that every community describes themselves. Nations, you have, some people say indigenous, some people say Indian, some people say, it's beautiful. We happen to all have come from Turtle Island, this continent, North America. And what I say, like in contemporary way to understand it, is that the thing that binds us is land, law, and legacy. These are things that sometimes we don't have control over the law, but that's still the thing. We live in the United States under federal Indian law. That is something that kind of pan-indigenizes us, that forces us to be on equal standing because we have to live under the Constitution and the white man's law called federal Indian law. The land obviously is continuing to be stolen from all of us. So this tragedy, this trauma, this blood memory exists in all of us. So we can look at the landscape and be like, borders, what are borders? Borders are colonial concepts. And so that is something that I think that we can empathize about. And then the legacy of what is our future? What do we want for the generations ahead? I think we all have the same kind of idea. Let's get the land back. Let's practice our own sovereignty, which again could be referenced back to law, so that we can have a safe place for the next seven generations. And so I think when people are working with, that's me working within the community that I'm familiar with, and I have learned to be culturally sensitive to that. If I'm working with the other community that I work a lot with, would be like the Black cyclist community. I'm never just going to show up and be like, I'm going to talk for you. I'm going to speak for you. I'm going to choose. No way. If it's an Asian community, if it's a disabled community, I'm going to be, like I said, if I'm a guest on the land, I'm a guest in this space. And I am going to ask permission to come in. So if you're somebody who's like a white race director or whatever, and you want to help build a panel, don't do it. Reach out to the folks who are already doing the work. You don't need to reinvent the wheel because it's still going to be from your perspective. You can bring these people in who are doing the work and then just step back. Don't micromanage. Don't ask for the receipts. They'll do what they're already doing.
And I guarantee each of these groups is going to be giving agency to the people in their group, right? And by you stepping back, you're giving each of them agency. That is the only way to do it, is to, that's how I would see it. If you're a white person with the money and the control and you're the decider, is don't ask any questions. Just really trust these people. The receipts are in the work that they have done in the community. So trust that. And I'm telling you, that's how you're going to get more people to want to build bridges. And that's how you build solidarity, really, is by saying, I trust what you're doing. I see what you're doing and I recognize it. And now I'm going to step off. It's like when I work in solidarity with the Black community, that's how I do it. I say, hey, I have $500. I would love to work with your community. Let's put together a ride. I'm just going to stand back here and I will write the check, so to speak. But you're already doing it. I just want to support you. I just want to work together.
I love that. That's very helpful. Thank you. So what does the future look like? What's next? What's Native Women Ride doing next? What have you got coming up next? What's next?
I'm working on my book. I've been working on a book for about 20 years, and I finally got into a writer's residency this past summer. It's the first time I ever was like, okay, I'm a writer. I am a writer, but really sat down and was like, I'm giving myself the time to think about this. And so I came away with a manuscript. And so my goal is to organize it into some kind of form to start sharing with editors mid-January when I turn 45. So my gift to myself for my 45th birthday is to finish that manuscript. So that's my focus for the next year, is really finishing this book that I've been working on for a long time. With Native Women Ride, it's the 3-year anniversary. And so I want to come up with some fun rides, and I'll continue to make silly t-shirts.
Awesome.
But that's about it. I don't plan too far ahead, because I don't have money for any of these things. It's like, when I have money, I email the group and say, got some money. Let's fix some bikes. You know what I mean? Yeah. Continue to do what I'm already doing, which is sharing stories, fundraising, mutual aid. And just trying to live in community in a good way. In a good way. I don't know. That's it. It's pretty basic, right? It should be.
And for our listeners, where are we finding you and how are we supporting you?
Okay, so I have a website, and you can donate, actually, because I have a fiscal sponsor now. So the website is nativewomenride.com. You can click on the donate link, and that'll take you right to the big fat donation page. I also have a Venmo link there. You can purchase t-shirts. A portion of the funds goes to Palestinian Relief, Children's Relief Fund, as well as back to Indigenous Cycling Collective. So you can follow me at Native Women Ride. My personal IG is Guarina, and I share a lot of my writing and photography and politics on that side too.
Listeners, you are going to find all of the links of the things we've talked about, links to the film, where to find Guarina, where to support Native Women Ride and all of her work, in the show notes for this episode. I'm going to have you back because I have 90 more questions. Thank you so much for the gift of your time today.
Thank you. This has been like the best conversation, honestly. I'm telling you, it's very exciting. Appreciate it.
And that's it for this episode. Thank you everyone for listening. Links on where to find Guarina and all of the things that we talked about are available on the show notes at BIPOCOutside.com. I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. And if you did, don't hesitate to smash the like button. I hope you'll join us again for another episode of BIPOC Outside.